Welcome back. It's the first day of summer, a season some longtime Washingtonians still associate with Gifford's Ice Cream, a local brand that looms large in many memories. But for Andrew Gifford, the heir apparent to the family business, the treat does not revive sweet memories. That's because Gifford's parents' crime and abuse overshadowed the joy you might expect from growing up in a local ice cream empire. In his new memoir, We All Scream, it's called, Gifford tells his story about growing up in Maryland, coming to terms with his childhood, and understanding his parents as flawed individuals. He joins us now in studio. Andrew Gifford, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The book, as I said, is called We All Scream, The Fall of the Giffords Ice Cream Empire. If you have questions or comments, 800-433-8850. You'll hear a story today that you may not have known before. If you were a patron of Gifford's Ice Cream, did you ever feel there was something untoward, if you will, unusual going on behind the scenes? Give us a call, 800-433-8850, or send us a tweet at Kojo Show, email to kojo@wamu.org. Andrew, I was wondering if even before you and I start talking, you could read a part of the prelude for your book. It might help those who are unfamiliar with your family's ice cream shop, or set the scenes for those who have not seen it in a long time.
Yes, I'd be glad to.
Please do.
So this from the prelude, the start of the book. We were ice cream people. We ran a multi-million dollar empire that had thrived since 1938. For generations of Washingtonians, our name was on the tip of the tongue when they thought of ice cream and candy. Presidents lined up for a scoop next to office workers and laborers. At the scarred wooden tables in the various Gifford's parlors around the D.C. area, lovers held hands and children celebrated their birthdays year after year. In the Gifford's parlor, watching a waitress balance a tray of sundaes as she approached your table, everything must have seemed perfect, beautiful even. Maybe I seem perfect, too. That boy under his mother's wing as she swanned past the tables toward the back of the store. What a dream to be the prince of ice cream. Except it wasn't. In 1979, I was five. Too young to understand much about our family business, let alone what was about to happen to it and to us. Today, I'm still not sure I understand. Gifford's Ice Cream and Candy Company was founded by my grandfather, John Nash Gifford. He died in 1976, leaving the business in turmoil. His wife, my grandmother Mary Frances, lay dying in a hospital bed. My father, Robert Nash Gifford, struggled for control of the empire against both his father's last surviving partner and my maternal grandfather, Alan Curry, who maneuvered to take over in my name. In the chaos, my mother, Barbara, signed on with my dad in an elaborate plan to siphon off profits and plunder the payroll and pension accounts. As a child, I knew none of this. My paternal grandparents were strangers to me, their history hidden, muddled, erased. From my parents, I learned only that I was an accident, easily ignored. What little I thought I knew about my family was a lie, and it would take me over three decades to figure that out. The fact was, long before the public end of Gifford's Ice Cream, my family had decided to kill it. This is a story about what was lost. It's a story about the dead. It's a story about me.
Andrew Gifford, reading from his new memoir, We All Scream. Your parents' failings were twofold. There were the criminal steps they took to steal from their own business, but there's also the psychological, emotional, and physical abuse they put you through as a child. For an example, can you share with us the memory at Deep Creek Lake, how and when you developed a fear of water?
I was, I think I was about 6 years old. It was 1979. And this was our family holiday. We would always go to Deep Creek every summer, and we would spend a long time there. Even after Dad took over at the ice cream parlor, it's July, we would go to Deep Creek. But in 79, we would just tour around the lake constantly throughout the day. And one day, my mother decided we were going to go into the cove where the dam has been made that makes the lake. And she teased me that we would get sucked under the dam, and all they would find would be three skeletons, mommy, daddy, and a little boy, and carried this prank on as far as she could until I was crying and in a panic. And, you know, even now, as I wrote this book in 2014, I dreamed of this lake, and I dreamed of
that. They actually went right close to the
dam. They went as close as they could.
And your father apparently pretended that he couldn't start the motor of the boat.
Yes. So they went to turn the key. It didn't start. And then they went to the emergency ripcord, just a little motorboat, and they pulled that. It didn't start. And they went through a whole act of, my God, the boat's dead. We're getting sucked into the dam. We're going to end up like those three skeletons. You know, we're going to die. And they carried this as far as they could until I just was screaming and crying. And
you were screaming. You were crying. You had urinated all over yourself, and they still kept on.
Yes.
Reminds me of a recent incident in which a family has ultimately been charged because of YouTube videos that they posted showing them terrorizing their children. That seems to have been a really terrifying experience for you. What long-term effect did it have?
I cannot go on the water these days. If I can't see the bottom, I panic.
There are a number of very, very, well, challenging stories about other abuse. How typical was that Deep Creek incident of what your childhood was like with your parents?
I feel like so much of this book is just mom's pranks. And there's so many of them throughout. You know, this was a day in the life with mom. She loved to see how far she could push you. And she did this even as a child with her siblings. You know,
found out later?
Yes, that I found out later. So as I sort of pieced her life together when I was writing the book, I found out that this was mom from when she was 4 years old. She would just find what button she could push and keep pushing until there you go.
What did you find solace in as a child and later as a young adult? Did you have a safe haven? If so, what was your safe haven?
Oh, geez. Books. I loved sci-fi. I loved fantasy. I loved zines. Folks like Pagan Kennedy and Answer Me and the Krylon Underground, all of these local zines that were just screaming out about how life is bad for other people as well. And that was something, you know, I was so isolated. I was an only child. Reading about how others also suffer opened my eyes that I wasn't alone.
Well, it was not just you who were suffering, but apparently at some point your mother and father engaged in what can only be described as a conspiracy to commit white-collar crime.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I believe they worked together. Certainly Dad did. But I believe they worked together to destroy the company, but not just simply tear the company down, but steal as much money as they could. My father and my mom's father, my maternal grandfather, ran a franchise scheme that was handshake only, $20,000. You can open up a Gifford's ice cream as long as you write the check over to us. And Dad ran with that money. Dad took the payroll and the pension accounts when he vanished. He cleaned out everything down to the cash registers. I even had the stupid little, you know, kids account where I had like $100 in it, and he forged my name to take that out of the bank. I learned at a reading the other day that he was plundering the health insurance accounts, and a lady came up to me and said, my friend's father died because there was no health insurance. Dad had taken that money and run with it.
A lot of the pain you endured as a child was emotional, psychological, but in early adulthood, you developed a debilitating disorder, which I am now going to try to pronounce, and you can tell me if I've got it correctly. It was trigeminal neuralgia.
Correct.
That even, well, tell us what the symptoms were.
So the trigeminal nerve is what you have in your face. It controls, you know, when you blink your eye, when you twitch your nose. It's the main trunk nerve in your face. And what happens with trigeminal neuralgia is a vein grows around the nerve. So with every heartbeat, the nerve is getting that you've been hurt, like mm-hmm. you've been stabbed sort of signal. So it is, I mean, they call it the suicide disease. People kill themselves because of this.
Because the slightest facial movement.
Everything.
Can be excruciatingly painful.
When the metro comes into the station, the wind would, I black out. I collapse from the pain. It was extraordinary. I couldn't sleep. I'd roll over, and it would be extraordinary.
As difficult as it was to live with that pain, apparently it also kept you from confronting the death of your mother, which happened a couple of years after you graduated college. You believe it to be a suicide. The authorities said it was an accident, but you believe it to be a suicide, and you felt guilty for it. Why? Mm.
Her whole townhouse in Frederick was set up like a suicide note. So after we found out, her car went off the road, burst into flames. It took them 2 weeks to identify her. And when we went to her house, she had laid out everything. She cleaned the house. The kitchen table had her purse, had her IDs, had all of her passwords, had all of the people to call, her bank accounts, everything laid out. Nice and clear. I think that sort of tells us she was up, you know.
It was apparently not until a life-changing surgery at the hands of the man who is now the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, but then was a Johns Hopkins surgeon, Ben Carson.
Yes.
That your pain subsided. Was it that surgery that gave you the energy to confront your family's past?
Yes. So while I was in pain, I ignored all of this. Giffords being rebooted again and again, I didn't care. Mom dying, I didn't care. And Dad dying, and all of the things that happened between 1995 and 2007, I was living hour by hour with this pain. I was a chronic pain sufferer trapped at home. So yes, Ben Carson cured me, of all people, with a very invasive brain surgery. 6 hours I was on the table, but the moment I woke up, I was cured of the pain, and I have been cured of the pain since. And I finally, yes, started to ask questions.
Most of what you hear about your family, I think, goes like this. We got an email from Mark who says, Giffords on Wisconsin Avenue was always a treat growing up in Bethesda in the 1960s. The classic three-scoop, three-topping banana split with whipped cream and nuts and served in a glass dish is defined in my mind by those who served at Giffords. A big Sunday for a young boy, thanks to his guest and family. That's the history that we in the public know. I used to go to Giffords in Silver Spring. But for you, when you began exploring your family's history, what questions did you want to answer, and did you find what you were looking for?
So I have such a darker side to this. You know, my family was cruel for generations. I believe my grandparents abused my dad. And
sexually?
Yes, and physically. It's been hard for me to kind of, I don't want to ruin the nostalgia that these people have. The big top is beautiful. That waitress coming to your table with the tray full of sundaes is wonderful. These are beautiful memories, and I don't challenge those. But I feel like the legacy should have faded away. It should be something on PBS that people, you know, remember as the long, long ago. You know, Giffords died in 1985, and yet in 2014, right before I started writing the book, and what inspired me to write the book is I sat down with somebody trying to reboot Giffords, and he said to me, it doesn't matter what's in the cup. As long as I say it's Giffords Swiss chocolate sauce, people will pay me anything I ask. And those people, there's like six attempts now to reboot it. Those people are out there taking advantage of the nostalgia, and they won't let it die. They won't let my grandparents or my parents die. and they'll just be cashing in on what you and the person on the email remembers, you know, because you will line up and pay $6 a scoop, and it doesn't matter what he's serving you as long as he whispers that it's Giffords. And that is irresponsible, in my opinion.
Is that one of the reasons you wanted to tell this story?
Yes.
When you tell people your story, people are quick to latch on to the abuse part, but you don't see your story as one of abuse. Why?
You know, it never occurred to me. It was my normal. It took the editor of this book asked me, he said, didn't your teachers do anything? Didn't anyone do anything? And I said, well, no. You know, I was always exempt from gym class. I never showered with the other kids. I never changed clothes. I was in the library. I would miss 4 to 6 weeks of school in a row, and my mom would say it was because I had severe allergies, and she now, I think, was getting forged excuses from the doctors at the Bethesda Hospital where she was working. And, you know, it took the editor. I said all that to him, and he said, oh, my God, well, that's how they're hiding the abuse. And it didn't occur to me.
But, as a child, you were kept in the dark about a lot of your family history. As an adult, how did you go about corroborating your family's stories? Who or what did you trust?
Oh, God, there's nothing to trust with these folks. They are liars and cheats and pranksters. Nothing is true about them. Trying to find out my dad, I mean, he has no public record. He's born, he graduates from Harvard, he volunteers for Vietnam, but then goes to a unit that doesn't exist in Berlin. And an army archivist that I'm talking to says, man, you need to stop asking about your dad, you know. And then the next time he pops up, he marries mom, you know. So these people were such they're a mystery. I really don't know if I got to the bottom of them.
Well, some of the mystery does unfold in the book, We All Scream. Before the book ends, you list the ingredients and directions for the Giffords ice cream base mix. The original recipe has long been sought after. Are you intentionally trying to break the cult around your family's ice cream? And if so, why?
I am, yes, because I think it's a foolish obsession. This is a very simple ice cream. It was made, my grandfather licensed the recipe out to Shenandoah's Pride. It was delivered to many ice cream factories in the area. Giffords was not unique. Giffords just didn't have any competition for decades. I just feel like the recipes have been traded again and again with all of these rebooters as the key to what makes their product unique. But the fact is, there are no secret recipes. There is no secret. It's just the
time. So you've taken that away from them. We're almost out of time, but we got a tweet from a listener who says, my parents would hide under my bed and grab my ankles, as well as jump out from behind doors and in closets. It says, Andrew Gifford, you are not alone. Is that one of the things you've discovered as a result of writing this
yes,
book?
Yes, and my God, thank you. Thank
Andrew you. Gifford, he is the author of We All Scream, The Fall of the Giffords Ice Cream Empire. Andrew Gifford, thank you so much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show today, but there's always more happening online. You can check our show's entire archive at kojoshow.org, where you can listen to a segment we did last fall about how ice cream shops contribute to placemaking and inject personality and vibrancy into local neighborhoods. You can also take us with you anywhere you go by signing up for our podcast via your favorite podcast service. Don't forget to meet us back here tomorrow at noon. We'll learn about a project where local teenagers teamed up to write a book about race and police accountability. We'll also conduct our summer reading conversation for young adults and child readers. That's all tomorrow at noon. Until then, thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
The Kojo Nnamdi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingelisa Schrobsdorf, Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Avery Kleiman, and Patrick Fort. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Cliff Gallagher has been on the phone. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.